Hello, if you enjoyed this podcast, you can support us. Just need to click on the link and become an Acast supporter. It's a one-off donation. You can give as much or as little as you like, and there's no commitment, but it certainly helps us to keep producing these podcasts. So thank you very much.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ideas in writing.
Hello, and welcome once again to Ideas in Writing. It's that kind of podcast with me, Philip Holden, and it's all about words and writing, words you might read here or see in books, and this time particularly words that you might hear in songs. It's supported by Mr. Books Bookshop in Tunbridge, and we've uploaded some conversations we've had so far at events. And the other week I was chatting with Ian Tucker Bell, but these conversations are one-to-one with some interesting people. And I'm recording this from my home studio using a bit of software called Zencastr. Mr. Books is an independent bookshop in Tunbridge. We call it the home of inspiring, imaginative and intelligent books, gifts and conversation. And you can find that at mrbooks.co.uk. You know what I mean. And you can order all kinds of books, new and secondhand. Or you can visit them, at least when they're open, and that should be fairly soon, I hope. Ideas in Writing is available on Anchor FM, but it's also available on other platforms, including Spotify, so have a look on your favourite podcast platform. So in these interviews, I asked my guest to come along with a word that means something to them. It could be a memory or a kind of a word they carry with them that means something to them, and I offer a word in exchange. So it's an occasional series, and this one is with the fabulous Tom Carradine, who many of you will know as a dapper chap around town. He lives in Tunbridge, the same town as the bookshop, and he has a great line in vintage clothing that he wears most of the time, and a magnificent moustache. But possibly you'll know him from Carradine's Cockney Sing-Along, which you can find on Facebook every Thursday evening at 8 p.m. British time. In this episode, I talked to Tom about his career a bit, but about his love of clever and emotional songwriting, and the collective memory we have of songs that go back well over a century. Both Tom and I came to London to go to university and ended up in university opera groups. In Tom's case, of course, he had musical talent on his side and ended up making a career of it, and we will chat a little bit about that. Tom brought along a word as requested. His word was quodlibet, which I'd never heard before, so I threw in a much simpler one, craft, which I think is entirely appropriate for the level of skill and passion Tom brings to his art. And I know this because he helped me out on a show that we reference briefly called Three Men in a Boat. at the Oast Theatre. So our conversation led us to thinking about some of the great lyricists and great piano entertainers, some beautiful and very clever songwriting from the likes of Victoria Wood, Flanders and Swann, Irving Berlin and others. So here we are with the episode called Quodlibet Craft with Tom Carradine. Thanks for joining me. How are you?
Absolute pleasure. I'm very well, thank you. Very well.
Good.
Well, despite the heat today,
I know
it's really sweltering.
I'm in a little sort of study, and that's it starts off really cool at the beginning of the day, and then the sun goes round, and it gradually heats up, and I'm now kind of sweating, thinking, why am I wearing clothes? And yeah, it's pretty awful.
Well, you're at home; you can get away with not wearing anything. I'm not wearing anything at the moment.
Oh
so.
Dear, yes.
Sorry, I've given it away, haven't I?
Yeah. anyway, yes. So the premise of this is that you bring along a word, and so do I. And you offered me the word in advance, which is very nice of you, because it gave me the chance to look at
a chance to find out what it was.
Yeah, tell me what the word is.
Quodlibet.
Quodlibet. Q.
Yes, it's a very
L I B E T.
Yeah, though I tend to use it in the term simultaneous quodlibet.
Oh, right.
Which is rather than just it on its own. But yeah, it came across this through a good friend of mine, Patricia Hammond, mm-hmm. who is a wonderful vintage singer. And she specializes in kind of music from the kind of turn of the century, I suppose. She did a great album a couple of years ago of World War One songs.
Okay.
And I've worked with her on quite a lot of projects. And she was the one who introduced me to this word, in that I'd been doing it for years.
Right.
Sounds really dodgy. I'd been using it for years and without knowing it.
Okay.
In that a quodlibet is two songs or two kind of musical compositions that fit over the top of each other. So like a counterpoint.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Or a kind of, and you might call it a canon, I suppose. Two kind of tunes.
Does that mean they have to have been written as separate songs and then put together?
Not necessarily, no. No. I mean, there are some fantastic moments of and songs that do fit together perfectly like that. And the reason why I came to find out, because I've been doing it for years, in my kind of sing-along work that I do, playing old-time songs and encouraging people to sing along, for years I'd known that you can sing Pack Up Your Troubles in Your Old Kit Bag, and It's a Long Way to Tipperary over the top of each other. And they fit.
Yes, I'm absolutely sure we did that as scouts.
I think absolutely. Yes. Yeah, there we go. Yeah. Well, that's where I remember it from. And so when I started doing some gigs with Patricia, and she was like, oh, well, we'll do It's a Long Way to Tipperary, we'll do Pack Up Your Troubles, and we'll do all the verses. And then at the end, we'll do the simultaneous quodlibet.
She said,
I was like,
that to you.
Sorry, back up. So just rewind a second. We'll do what? Yeah. She was like, oh, no, we'll do the simultaneous quodlibet at the end. I'll take Pack Up Your Troubles, and you take It's a Long Way to Tipperary. I was like, oh, okay. But what? And she explained simultaneous quodlibet. That's the technical term for two songs which fit over the same chord sequence. Something that I was just inherent in me, I suppose. I'd kind of known.
Yeah.
Again, there's lots of other examples of that. Things like, I've been doing it as a vocal warm up for years. Things like, I believe the children are our future. Teach them well and let them lead the way. And over the top of it, you can sing, I believe I can fly. I believe I can touch the sky. The chords are the same.
Okay.
And they fit beautifully. And it works beautifully as a kind of counterpoint. And just two medleys molding together. And then there's other examples of where people have particularly written songs, written material to fit a quodlibet. So some great examples of things like the wonderful Gilbert and Sullivan, great operetta writers from the Victorian era, like their ends of act ones, where they've got everybody singing different parts that all fit the same. That fit the same accompaniment, but they might quote songs that came earlier on in the show. Also, a bit like, I suppose, Les Miserables as well.
Yes.
At one finale, One Day More, when everybody's singing these songs that fit over the top of each other in this very clever way.
Yes.
Anybody think they might have thought about when they were putting these songs together originally in the show that they might just all pull together in one end of Act One number?
Do you think they wrote them like that? I suppose they must have done.
I mean, well, there's lots. I know Les Mis Inside Out. I had the great pleasure of being a deputy keyboard player on it up in the West End over a good kind of 5 or 6 years. So I've played it far too many times. but it's interesting that there's lots of the musical kind of, you'd call them leitmotifs, I suppose, in opera. Yeah. But there's kind of musical motifs that come back. Mm-hmm. And so the kind of descending bass line, if you can hear that, for I Dreamed a Dream, which appears all over the place and appears in One Day More as well.
Yes, yeah.
So it's because it's kind of rooted on that, then you can kind of, it's very cleverly done. I really admire composers who can do
but
that.
Does,
and another one of my favourites is...
I was going to say, it does do something for the audience. You know, there's a sort of dramatic irony effect, isn't there? Because the audience kind of know what's coming.
And, there is
and
indeed.
And there's a sort of familiarity to it. But... it adds layers of meaning or complexity to it.
It does. It's very, very clever. And that, you're right. There's a payoff to it. And almost, it's like it's bigger than the sum of the parts.
Yeah.
Because you follow the story, and even little bits of these motifs that come back and keep recurring, mm-hmm. that are kind of like way markers that you might not necessarily notice, but your brain is just kind of subliminally appreciating, so that when they kind of pay off at the end of Act One, I mean, it's an amazing moment. And had the great pleasure of playing it, as I said, far too many times, but there's still a kind of hairs on the back of the moment when everything comes together and you've got kind of eight different parts music which all just fit beautifully and rise to a rousing end of Act One. Yeah. Then it's time to go and grab a drink or go to the toilet.
Yes, I think that...
It's a bit like Pavlov's dog. I can't hear One Day More without thinking, oh, I really need the loo.
Is that right? Yeah. You mentioned Gilbert and Sullivan there. Just thinking, end of Iolanthe, isn't it?
Iolanthe Act One finale. The best. For me, it's the double chorus when the go away, madam, I should say, madam, you bearded by this puny mortal.
Yes.
Oh, it's just it's stirring stuff.
Great music,
it really is.
It's great music.
Yeah, and actually, I think in kind of thinking about the similarities between the musical writing and the lyric writing, there's moments in musical theatre or operetta where there's a real kind of is synergy the word? There's a real kind of matching of an equality between the music and the lyrics, and they that just come together and become something, as I said, that kind of more bigger than the sum of the parts.
Yeah,
that everything kind of feeds into that moment, and that's one of them. One of my favourite Iolanthe, actually one of my favourite Gilbert and Sullivan operettas. Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah. The overture is magnificent to start with, I think.
It is too, and actually I think. My wife will correct me. She's the big G&S buff, but we met doing Gilbert and Sullivan together, actually. Yeah. But I think Iolanthe was one of the few overtures that Sullivan actually wrote himself.
I think that's right, yes. Yeah.
Because the majority of the others were kind of shipped out to arrangers and the musical directors on the show. And because everything, especially for when they were writing them originally, they were thrown together so quickly. I think there's a story or something that he was writing the overture to HMS Pinafore while on the boat going out to the States for the first performance of it.
Okay,
So there's those kind of things that get thrown together and put together. But the Iolanthe overture is beautiful.
It is.
Or kind of 8 or 9 minutes worth of. But again, that's another thing with overtures in musical theatre, where they're written to give you a kind of preview of the songs in the show, so that when you come to hear them in the show, you're already comfortable with them. Oh, we've heard this
true,
nice
yes.
jolly tune before, or if it just, I don't know. Again, it's this kind of subliminal thing with musical theatre writing, especially where I suppose it's just a given kind of trope or a given kind of method of working. But those tunes in the overture give you a kind of an awareness of them, so that when they come in the show, they don't kind of shock you. They're like, I recognize this tune.
I suppose in a way it's sort of giving you the vocabulary of the rest of the show, isn't it? It's sort of, you know, we're going to use these terms, we're going to use this kind of emotion or sentiment, or so when it comes, as you say, it's you know it straight away.
Yeah, and you're right about setting the tone. I mean, it's the same if you like classic opening paragraphs or chapters of books.
Yes.
You know as soon as you've read the first couple of sentences, it kind of sets stall for what you're in for in reading the rest of it. And same way with an overture or the way the start of a show is created or produced. I mean, I remember vividly watching, going to see, a lot of people hated it, but it was a Martin Guerre, the kind of, was it the third or fourth Alan Bubilum, Claude Michel Schoenberg musical? So they'd written Les Mis, which was a big hit. Yeah. They'd written Miss Saigon. So it would have been, I think it was the third one.
Yeah.
So they thought it was going to be a real kind of huge hit, and there was lots of talk about it. Would have been kind of around about the late 1990s before I moved to London. Mm-hmm. I remember coming down and seeing it, and it was kind of the first show I think I'd ever seen live that didn't start with a big glitzy glamorous overture, something kind of like big and Broadway. It started off, the lights went down, and there was a solo flute in the pit. Da da da. Ja, ja, ja. It was just like, whoa, okay, this is different.
Yeah.
And then the strings come in, and the whole opening, this kind of, they didn't call it an overture, they called it a prologue. There was stuff going on stage as you introduced the villagers in this French village. But the strings came in, and the kind of the way that it set the tone for the evening, the woodiness of the strings gave a real kind of a grounding to it, yeah, as a kind of an earthy piece, I suppose.
Yeah.
And the woodwinds as well. It gave it, it put it specifically in that moment, in that period, in that location, which was masterful. In the same way, as I was saying, in a book, you read the opening couple of paragraphs, and you're there. You know where you are. What it kind of sets out the stall for the rest of the experience, I suppose.
Yeah. Well. It won't surprise you, well, it might surprise you to know that the word I chose to bring along was craft. I have to be careful how I say it, because I would say craft. Normally.
Of course. Me too.
Well, I was going to ask you, you know, you mentioned about coming down to London. So where did you come from?
Born and raised in Coventry in the Midlands, which is very odd because I'm not northern enough to be a northerner, and I'm not southern enough to be a southerner. So I would say I'm a Midlander.
Yeah.
But to a lot of people, that's not anything. It's like when I came down to London, everyone was, oh, you're a northerner. And I was like, no, I'm a Midlander. I mean, the closest I come to a kind of local accent or dialect, I suppose. My father is a Brummy from the Black Country. Is from the Black Country.
Yeah,
and not a Brummy. That would be offensive to him. Right. But then, so he's got. It's mellowed over the years, but when he gets on full on Brummie, it's lovely. All right, talk here, market. Come to Birmingham. Well, that kind of thing. I love it. It's a beautiful sound, and the Coventrian accent is kind of edging on that. It's very lazy, I suppose. But yeah, when I came to London, everyone just took the mick out of me, thinking I was a northerner, and I'm not. I'm a Midlander.
No, you're definitely not a northerner.
And now when I go back to Coventry, oh, you're very posh now. Yeah. You speak posh and proper. I don't know. I think a very generic. I don't know where my accent kind of lies. And equally, depending on who I'm with, I'm quite my accent changes. So I quite easily emulate other people or people's lilt of their accents.
So when you came down to go to Imperial College, that's right.
I did. Yes.
Yeah. For
to study a biochemistry degree, as everybody does, don't they?
Yeah.
Especially when they want to be an actor, which I wanted to be until I then realised while I was at college I couldn't act. And I'm glad I did, because there are lots of actors out there who haven't realised that yet.
And sure, I've worked with
a few.
Oh, right, okay.
But no, came down to London. I'd always enjoyed music and performing arts, and I always thought it was something I wanted to pursue. But no, I believe careers advice and people telling me to go and get a proper job, get a proper degree, and then you can enjoy. And actually, one of the reasons why I came to London was A, because I was a big musical theatre fan and I wanted to enjoy all that London had to offer in that respect. But also the fact that The Musical Theatre Society and the Operatic Society at Imperial were well respected.
Yes.
And of the other universities that I looked at, Imperial was the one to come to for that. So came to London in 2000.
Yes.
Or moved to London in 2000, and was there for 7 or 8 years. So through university and finding a partner, my wife Faye, we got married, and then we moved out back to Kent, back to Tunbridge. Yeah.
So the music, where does your music come from? Is it a musical family?
Not really. My mum played a bit of piano, and my dad sang a lot. My dad and I did amateur shows together with the Coventry Scout Gang show, so kind of scout shows when I was a kid. And dad started it first, and then I joined the Cub section, which was great. And I suppose actually in my kind of grounding of music for the career that I have at the moment, or I suppose did until COVID came along, were all of those old time songs, music hall songs and wartime songs. And as you were saying earlier on, those kind of scout camping kind of singing around the campfire songs, which have always kind of fascinated me. And So that was my kind of grounding, really. And singing with, I was a churchgoer as a kid, sang with a church kind of singing group, and we sang a lot of musical theatre and sacred songs as well.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I'm assuming that you had piano lessons.
I did, but I didn't really enjoy them. I started piano lessons when I was about 6, and I hated it.
I wasn't kind of forced.
I finished my piano lessons when I was about 15,
because
I was just sick and tired of classical repertoire.
Oh, okay. So you obviously got quite a long way with them, because I gave up when I was 11, and
I don't know, I just wasn't interested. I got to grade 5 of on ABRSM grades, and I just didn't enjoy the classical repertoire. I was always intrigued by playing jazz. I kind of got into jazz as a teenager and listening to, it was ragtime especially. I just didn't enjoy the classical repertoire. I ended up doing a lot of basically avoiding playing all the classical repertoire by doing all the fun pieces. I think I gave up kind of when I was 15 or 16 and went into A levels of kind of formal piano lessons.
Yeah.
But I even before then, I'd been going to Coventry City Library every Saturday and digging off the shelves all the old musical kind of vocal selections and vocal scores. Yeah. And I'd take those and I'd borrow the CDs or the tapes, and I'd take them home and I'd sit and I'd pour over the scores while listening to the albums.
Yeah.
And that was my real kind of grounding in musical theatre especially. I love listening to musical theatre albums as a kid, and that was just the kind of the next step, I suppose, trying to emulate that, playing those songs on the piano, which again, skills that taught me through learning how to read, read sheet music and to read lead sheets as well, which is just when you get a vocal line and chord symbols, which look easy to guitar players because that's the way they learn.
Yeah.
But to a pianist, to a classical pianist, to read chord symbols can often be quite initially quite daunting. But now I kind of learnt my way through those and self-taught, I suppose, because I emulated what I was hearing on recordings. And through that gave myself a great kind of grounding in kind of jazz piano and busking, you'd call it busking, I suppose, improvising and just kind of playing by ear as well, picking out songs that I'd enjoyed and listened to on the radio or listened to on albums, and picking it out and working out how to play it. If for example, when new musicals came out in London, if I couldn't get the sheet music for them, because often it wasn't released at the time, I'd sit down and I'd work out the latest tunes and things, which I suppose, looking back now, was a great grounding for what I do now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, for people who don't know what you're doing right now, I mean, every week on Facebook, how would you describe it?
I've taken my live act onto a live stream, basically. So for the last 6 years, I suppose, I've been making the majority of my living as a full-time musician from playing sing-along piano. Mm. So old-fashioned kind of pub piano. I have the great joy to have in the back of my van, I've got an upright piano, Kimberly. She replaced my previous piano, Evie, who is currently in our back garden, who needs to be taken apart and disposed of. I do get through pianos. But I have a real upright piano that is bolted to heavy duty wheels. And before lockdown, I'd be playing pub gigs or playing kind of vintage events and WIs and kind of golf club events and things like that, singing all the old fashioned songs, be that Victorian musical songs or wartime songs, or even those novelty songs from the 1950s and 60s, things like "You're a pink toothbrush, I'm a blue toothbrush," or "Does your chewing gum lose its flavor on the bedpost overnight?" So all these songs have a kind of collective nostalgia, I suppose, and are rooted in that kind of London, especially that London pub sing-along tradition, very much in the style, piano style of someone like Mrs. Mills.
Yeah,
and those kind of party albums from the 60s and 70s, also Max Bygraves, one of my great musical idols, Max Bygraves, and those kind of sing-along albums that he produced back in the 70s too. So yeah, I make a living from pushing that around and playing pub gigs, and before COVID, I had a Thursday night residency at Mr. Fogg's Tavern in Covent Garden, a kind of Victoriana themed pub where I would rock up every Thursday night with my piano, and for 2 hours would just get everybody in the pub singing. That could be the old songs, that could be a Mary Poppins medley or an ABBA medley or a Beatles medley, anything. I thought about this long and hard when I started playing there about 4 or 5 years ago, about what is the essence of a pub sing-along. And I realized that, I mean, because I could do a perfectly Victorian pub sing-along, but the problem is that no one would know all of the songs. They might know a few of them, things like "Daisy Daisy" or "I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles," or "Maybe It's Because I'm a Londoner." But actually, to get an audience having the experience of an old-fashioned kind of music hall evening or a Victorian kind of pub sing-along is actually singing songs that they know and that they can all raise their voices with, which means doing a Beatles medley or singing Bohemian Rhapsody. It's bizarre. Talking about writing, one of the most complicated songs to sing, one of the most complicated songs to play. The lyrics are crazy. I mean, if you dissect them, they are just nonsense. Yes, yes. But everybody knows it.
It is strange, isn't it? I mean, coming back to this idea of the craft, is all these songs kind of, there's a sort of natural selection that process that means we know them or we remember them or we want to sing along with them. And
indeed, I think
and there are millions of songs that we don't want to sing along with. And,
well, certainly with the music hall repertoire. I mean, in my years of experience with kind of performing music hall and working on the music hall circuit over the last kind of, again, 6 years or so, I suppose, there's probably, in the grand scheme of things, there's probably about 50 music hall songs that people within the music hall community really kind of know. Mm. In the wider community, I suppose there's probably only maybe someone walking down the street, there might be, If they might have an awareness of musical, they might know 10 of those, or at least the choruses anyway.
Yeah.
But actually, I mean, of actual music hall songs that people know in common kind of parlance, I suppose, I'd say "Daisy Daisy." Everybody knows "Daisy Daisy, give me a round to do." Maybe "I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles."
Yeah.
And perhaps "My Old Man Said Follow the Van," the chorus of that. Yeah. But then we kind of get on to dodgy territory as it kind of disappears, and but then again, of those musical songs, they relied, because they were written in a time before the wireless, before TV, before kind of mass communication, those songs relied on the songs being memorable and the audience singing along to the choruses. That was what they were all about, kind of chorus sing-along. And because after you'd go and see the show, you might have seen Mari Lloyd at the Hackney Empire playing to 2,500 people, and she would sing "Don't Dilly Dally" on the way, and you walk out and you've been singing along to that chorus, "My old man said fun." Okay, and then you or one of your family, you go to the sheet music shop, you go to a music shop and you buy that sheet music. So you needed to remember the song, or at least the name of the song, or the performer to ask for it. And then, of course, you'd bring it home, and every house had a piano, a parlor piano, and at least someone in the family, Auntie Doris or sort of someone, Uncle Dave, would play the piano and could bash out, no matter in what kind of quality, I suppose, could bash out those tunes. And that's the way they got passed on.
Yeah, of course, that's about participation, isn't it? So the sort of association with those songs was about joining in and sharing them rather than sort of listening passively.
Absolutely, that was the whole crux of it. And also, I suppose for the real kind of wealth of music hall material, anyway, because it was a working class tradition, it was the predominantly working class audiences were seeing on stage reflections of themselves. So someone like Marie Lloyd, the great queen of the music halls, playing a kind of quite a feisty, I suppose, Victorian or Edwardian woman, who she was exactly. There were many of her in the audience, as it were, and in the same way, the wonderful Costa comics, so the costermonger, the street seller kind of comics. There was a great swathe of them, people like Harry Champion and Gus Elan, and Albert Chevalier as well, who sang all these songs, things like "If It Wasn't for the Houses in Between," yes, or "I'm Henry the Eighth, I Am," all those kind of songs that portrayed these working class gentlemen. And again, that was just reflecting the people that were in the audience, and they really felt a connection with the material. I mean, we don't talk about the fact that Albert Chevalier was actually a middle-class guy from South Kensington, but whereas Harry Champion was very much working class, and Gus Elan too.
Right.
But yes, Albert Chevalier put on this character of a working-class costermonger, really? And made great success with things like. On My Old Dutch, We've Been Together Now for 40 Years. Yeah. Some great lyrics, some great songs that have really kind of survived the test of time, I suppose.
Yeah, and that's what I'm curious about, really. I mean, I felt like I knew lots of songs. I mean, or at least songs were kind of, I knew that they existed, and I knew maybe a bit of the melody. And when you and I did, what's it called? Oh, Three Men in a Boat. That's right.
Three Men in a Boat.
Yeah. A lot of those songs were in there, and that turned out I didn't know them really. So it's a good job you were there.
Well, it's funny. It's funny how, again, the way that songs get passed down. I'm really fascinated with. Again, if we're talking about kind of spoken word, I suppose the oral tradition of these songs.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated by. I kind of liken it a bit to Cecil Sharp. Who was the kind of folk music historian back in the teens and 20s, and his trips that he did over to the Appalachians in the States and the mountain range, where he was noting down and cataloguing songs and how they'd been passed on.
Yes.
And a lot of those, of course, were Victorian songs that got taken across, or even earlier kind of broadside ballads or folk songs that got taken across with early settlers and then more immigrants that move over to the States. But equally, the fact that you could, on one side of a mountain, you could be singing one version of a song, but then on the other side of the mountain, they would be singing the same song, maybe perhaps the same tune or a slightly different tune, but slightly different lyrics. And it makes you wonder about how that got passed on, whether that was in some drunken night, someone had sung it, someone had listened to it, but they'd, in a kind of Chinese whispers way, had picked up the wrong words, or that those words were changed for a specific reason.
Yeah, it is fascinating.
I mean, certainly in London, there's a great song called Barrow Boy, which goes, it's an old traditional kind of costermonger song. All my life I wanted to be a barrow boy I've always wanted to be. And I've got about six or seven different versions of that, different tweaks to the lyrics. Things like, I'm a coster from over the Lambeth side. Mm-hmm. If you lived on the south side of the river, the Lambeth side, that's where a lot of the costermongers came from.
Okay.
And pushed their barrows across the river into the city to trade. So you get across over the Lambeth side or over the other side. I've got my papers, I carry them with pride. Or I hold me title, I carry it with pride. So, I mean, it might only be a four or five lyrics in the version of the song, but they are changed and they are different. Same with some people know, always. I love it when people say, can you say, my old man said follow the band?
Oh really? Like,
yeah, I'm like, no, the song's My Old Man Said Follow the Van, and they sing it, but my nan used to sing it, My Old Man Said Follow the Band. So for them, that's the version of the song that they know. And equally, then we get into the lovely, that I love kind of playing with, is the kind of rude and risque versions as well, the kind of the parody lyrics.
Yeah.
I mean, especially you only have to look at some of the World War One songs, of course, and the way that the boys fighting out in the trenches came up with their own parody versions of them.
Yes.
And again, in that kind of I suppose because I've never been a writer myself. Because I always find if I ever write anything, be it written, kind of lyrics wise, I suppose, or music, I always find I'm kind of parodying things. It always sounds like something.
Yeah, but I don't think that's a problem, Tom. I'm going to test you here. Do you know dashing away with a smoothing iron?
I do. "'Twas on a Monday morning when I beheld my darling. She looked so neat and charming in every high degree. She looked so neat and nimble, oh, a washing of the linen. Oh, dashing away with the smoothing iron, dashing away with the smoothing iron. She stole my heart away."
Perfect. That one. So you know Flanders and Swann?
I do.
The gas man came.
Of course. "'Twas on a Monday morning that the gas man came to call. Very well spotted. Yeah. The gas I wouldn't turn, I wasn't getting..." There we go. I suppose you're right.
But
that's the thing. Parody has always been kind of looked down upon, I suppose.
Yeah.
But it's a common theme across music and lyrics, I suppose.
But I think it sort of has to be, doesn't it? It has to be part of the sort of evolution of music, that you take a form or a kind of melody or even just a phrase like that that people are familiar with, and you do something different with it.
I suppose so. And actually, I mean, it goes back to things like hymn tunes, I suppose,
or even
things like, as I said, the broadside ballads, kind of English folk poems that were written that fitted a standard meter, so that actually you could sing it to any number of tunes because they all fitted the same thing. Or the same with hymn tunes. They have a scansion to them. Is that a word? Am I making that up?
Scansion, but meter.
They have a meter to them, which, if as long as you find a tune that matches the same meter, you can sing it to a different tune.
Yeah.
So I suppose. And again, maybe it's just the fact that kind of parody has always been kind of looked down upon as a musical form. But actually, a lot of so much creativity comes from parody,
and also
when you've got a great parody where it is so, the lyrics are so close to the original,
but I'm
trying to think of examples now and I can't think of any, but great comedy writers, people like, I mean, my kind of bread and butter of comedy at the piano, especially people like Flanders and Swann, people like Victoria Wood, Tom Lehrer, all of those great comedians at the keyboard Victoria Wood's a great one, that she could play something she did a great version of Oh Dear, What Can the Matter Be?
Oh, really?
8 o'clock at night on a Saturday, Tracy Clegg and Nicola Battersby leading their way into town. And it's a kind of wonderful story about these two girls out on the tiles and how they end up, kind of falling into bushes but again, it's a parody. Because you hear that kind of children's kind of folk songy kind of thing, oh dear, what can the matter be? Your brain's going, okay, well, it's this kind of thing. But then she kind of just turns it on its head. It's wonderful,
it's certainly glorious creation. It's certainly better than just a parody, if you know what I mean. I think you know what you were saying earlier again about the craft of words and music going together and making something that's greater than the individual parts. I think Victoria Wood is a perfect example of that. I think sometimes, I mention Flanders and Swann, of course, were the first and second law of thermodynamics, which you'd be familiar with.
Of course, yeah.
Or Have Some Madeira. You know that one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Not to play it. Have Some Madeira.
Yes.
I mean, it's a music hall song, basically. It's a music hall waltz, or same as a swathe of songs from the 1880s and 1890s, they've kind of, after the ball is over, all of those kind of things. So you're exactly in that,
they're very clever. I've been playing the Flanders and Swann albums recently, and there are obviously elements that are dated, but they're still funny and they're still very clever and engaging and I noticed that.
One of my favourite ones, and the one poem I was singing the other day, You could do lots of things with a wampum. Yes. You can use any part of it too. It's a triumph, it's a treasure, it's a... Oh, and there's nothing that a wampum can do. And I forget the lyrics, there we go. but oh, yes. Oh, and the hippopotamus song. And that's another one. Everybody knows the mud, mud, glorious mud. Whether they've heard the verse before, that's another thing. But yeah, it's those kind of songs that... Yeah, Flans and Swan, absolute great exponents of that.
And solipsis, do you know what solipsis is?
Oh, no. Sounds like something you need a cream for.
Yes, or zeugma, or zeugma.
Oh, no, go on.
Well, I'm not sure
Educate
I can explain
me.
Exactly what it is, but I can give you the example from Have Some Madeira, Madeira.
So
at the end of the verse, I'll read the verse. She was young, she was pure, she was new, she was nice, she was fair, she was sweet, 17. He was old, he was vile, he was no stranger to vice, he was base, he was bad, he was mean. He had slyly inveigled her up to his flat to view his collection of stamps, at which point Michael Flanders intones, all unperforated. And then and then the last two lines of this zeugma or solipsis. And then he said, as he hastened to put out the cat, the wine, his cigar, and the lamps. So it's that compression.
Yeah.
And they repeat that. So that it didn't. It's not just a one-off. So later on, he said, she let go her glass with a shrill little cry. Crash, tinkle, it fell to the floor. When he asked what in heaven, she made no reply, up her mind and a dash for the door.
It's glorious, isn't it? And again, it's very much of an age and of a time. Although, I mean, I'd question to say that quite a lot of Flans and Swans stuff is timeless, I suppose. Mm. But it places you exactly in that, and that their kind of turn of phrase is beautiful, absolutely beautiful.
And what I think it does comedically is it sort of tickles you and then doesn't let you go because there's another, another.
Another thing with Victoria Wood is the way that she would ride that ripple.
Yes.
You can, I wish I'd got some examples now, but there's moments I can certainly remember, like when I vividly went watching, when I must have been about 11 or 12, and I remember recording her live at the Royal Albert Hall off TV, and I wore the video out, replaying it, and taking down the lyrics. And then learning the songs. It made some very interesting conversations at the dinner table when I had to ask my mum what menopause was. But it's funny how, there would be moments where she would, there'd be a small gag or a small kind of, and then it would build through a line. And actually, you're already laughing by the time you get to that final line. It's not just some kind of jokey lyrics are all about the payoff at the end of the line. It's all about setup and a gag at the end of a line or a funny rhyme that you're expecting, for example.
Yeah.
But there are moments in Victoria Wood which just shows her craft indeed, where that kind of ripple of, and I suppose most of it comes from kind of association or realization. Again, it's a bit like music hall, the fact that people in the audience know exactly what they're talking about, in the same way that Victoria Wood's audience is when she talks about flip-flops or spam or tripe or having an apron on to chop my veggies, have tiny cactus on my window ledges, have a roller blind with scalloped edges. I mean, there's a laugh in every rhyme
And you don't feel
Mrs. Pugh.
You don't feel that the comedy is being compromised to fit the lyrics to the music. It's of a piece, isn't it? It's beautifully put together.
It is indeed. And also knowing, having seen documentaries and things about the way she worked, especially, and even the spoken word stuff, her wonderful sketches and skits, the fact that she would slave over those. And actually, when you were talking to Ian on the last podcast about the way that as a writer, when you write something and you kind of insist that people say as it's been written, because that's the way you wrote it. You might have spent hours on getting that right, that line right, and the balance of words right. Same with Victoria Wood. She was quite particular about the way that people said her lines because she'd crafted them in that way.
Yes.
In order for especially the kind of I don't know, she has a great kind of, there's a great kind of sing-songiness about Victoria Wood's spoken lines and the way that they they take a great, I don't know, it's just a kind of a comedic flow.
I think there's a sort and of also for relish, me, it, isn't there? There's a relish in the words themselves.
There, yeah, indeed, and there's a real there's a relish there. There's also she inherently knew how a word would work in a sentence.
Yes.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
And in the same with songs. And for me, it's those where she would throw in a particular brand of something. What, Beat Me on the Bottom with a Woman's Weekly. Yes. I mean, there we go. Frieda and Barry.
Yes.
Beat Me on the... It can't be anything else. I mean, I would challenge anyone to find a better ladies' magazine that would fit that gap and get us such a laugh. It doesn't. Or smearing avocado on Milo portions. I mean, it's just... genius, and one of my greatest regrets is that I never got to meet her or to work with her. I have lots of friends who have over the years, and actually a good friend of mine, Steve Edis, his wife was her PA for quite a while. So we were kind of like 1 degree of separation away, but I never had the joy of meeting her. But by all accounts, from everyone I've spoken to about her, said she was an amazing woman.
Yeah, certainly the work speaks for itself, really, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
I noticed you mentioned on your Cockney sing-along yesterday, the Chemical Elements song.
Yes. Well, again, it's the link between Tom Lehrer and Gilbert and Sullivan. In that it used to be my party piece. I haven't done it for years. Let me see whether I can remember
it. Because
of course,
thing,
there's antimony, arsenic, aluminium, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthium, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, and protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium. It's amazing how it comes back.
Yeah. So
unfortunately, the piano part doesn't. But
well, it's not easy music to play, is it? I mean, you know,
it's a bit. Well, though, actually, it's in the original key is in E flat.
Oh,
when
right,
Tom Lehrer does it, he does it in C. So it's just a lot of the white keys.
Oh, okay.
So I have no excuses, really.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll edit that bit out. the other song that I think is almost perfection because it makes me laugh no matter how many times I hear it is the Ivan Novello one. And Mother Came Too.
Again, I mean, Ivan Novello, a great composer, what a matinee idol as well, a great performer, great actor. But he had a real legacy. I mean, I would struggle to find someone of that era who wrote such beautiful soaring melodies. Yes. He was a real kind of tunesmith. I suppose, I mean, it sounds really cheap to say, but the kind of Andrew Lloyd Webber of his day. I mean, Andrew Lloyd Webber and I don't see eye to eye on a number of things, but he knows how to write a melody. He does know how to write a melody. And same with Ivor Novello. Things like, we'll gather lilacs in the spring again and walk together down an English lane. I mean, it's just... makes me swell even thinking about it. But the fact he was so clever with that, as well as writing things like "And Mother Came Too,"
which is just again, genius. What I love about it is that everyone knows what's coming, but the deliveries and it has a great punchline.
Indeed. And also the verse as well that people might not know. How does it go? They seem to be the victim of a cruel jest. It dogs my footsteps with the girl I love the best. I mean, this is beautiful and lyrical. She means the, it's too high for me, sweetest thing that I had never known. But still we never get the chance to be alone. And then it becomes just as, my car will meet her, and her mother comes too. It's a two-seater, still her mother comes too. At zeros when I am free, at dinner, supper or tea, she likes to shimmy with me, and her mother does too. We buy her trousseau, and her mother comes too. Ask not to do so, still her mother comes too. She simply can't take a snub. I go and sulk at the club, then have a bath and a rub, and her brother comes too. It's joyous, isn't it?
And it's beautiful music as well, isn't it?
It really is. And the fact that he can go, I mean, it was perfect for the 1920s. Or was that 1921, one? That it the it goes from that beautiful... certainly knew how to write a melody, as I said. And then into just that kind of jolly, kind of gentle foxtrot.
Yes.
And just the way the lyrics just kind of skip over the top. Again, if we're talking about people who really kind of that era, I suppose, who really captured not only beautiful music, but also beautiful lyrics and funny lyrics. It was, of course, Noel Coward, the master himself. I'm a great Noel Coward fan. And he can go from such poignant songs like London Pride. London Pride has been handed down to us. London Pride is a flower that's free. And some great emotive lyrics in that one. What was I singing the other day? They're out of sorts in Sunderland and terribly cross in Kent. They're dull in Hull and the Isle of Mull is seething with discontent. They're nervous in Northumberland and Devon is down the drain. They're filled with wrath on the Firth of Forth and sullen in Salisbury Plain. And what's the chorus? I can't remember the chorus now. hurrah, hurrah, hooray.
Misery's
here to stay. There are bad times just around the corner and the outlook's absolutely vile. There are dark clouds over the dullish cliffs of Dover and the rats are preparing to leave the BBC. And there's a great line in that about we're going to unpack our troubles from our old kit bag.
Yes.
It's just glorious.
Yes, which is just a little musical quote as well, isn't it?
There's so many of those little things like that, certainly that Noel would do. I was chatting to someone the other day about... down at the old Bull and Bush. Come and make eyes at me down at the old Bull and Bush. Da 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 da. Which in the middle has the hear the little German band. Da 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 da. Which is a little quote of Odi Lieber Augustin, this Bavarian kind of drinking song. So a little quote of that. Actually, it was a couple of weeks ago on the live stream. I sang the. Oh, Odi Lieber Augustin. But then that also, that. Sorry, I'm off on one now. Now we've done that. Augustin, oh, dearly but Augustin, Allison, or something, whatever the words are there, which is about in Vienna in the 1600s. It's about plague happening.
Really?
And Augustin, who is the kind of local minstrel, he plays the bagpipes. That's it. He plays the bagpipes. Your local bagpipe, friendly bagpipe player. Does he fall ill or something? But he ends up falling into the plague pit, and the only way that he gets out is by playing the bagpipes to attract the attention of people that he's been put in the. Oh no, he doesn't fall in. People take him. It's a bit like Spamalot. It's a bit like I'm Not Dead Yet, where he gets taken to them, put into the plague pit, but he's okay, and they get him out in the end, and all the hilarity that ensues. But there we go. So there's that one, but also in the UK, that tune is used as. I remember as a scout, you can't put your muck in Arderspin, Arderspin, Arderspin. You can't put your muck in Arderspin, Arderspin's full. And then you can sing that as a simultaneous quote libet with, there's one about fish and chips and vinegar. And fish and pepper, hot. And there's a bottle of pop. So there's something about bottle of pop, which like works as a little kind of counter melody underneath. there's another one. Can't put your muck in Arderspin. It'll come back to me. But yeah, there's like four different versions of that you sing as to bring it back to, as a simultaneous quote libet.
Wow, that's amazing.
I knew I was getting somewhere with that explanation.
Yeah, but it's I just think it's there is something about that marriage of music and words that. Yeah, it does something more with an audience that's sort of engaged and participating. And
actually, you're right. And as exemplified by people like Victoria Wood and certainly Tom Lehrer in recordings that I've heard.
Yes,
they knowing how to place a gag before a musical break and knowing how long that musical break is going to be.
Yeah.
There's Victoria Wood things where. In different recordings, she'll add an extra beat or an extra bar because of the audience laughter.
Yes.
On a recording, she might just plow through, but on a live recording, in the same way that she was a comedian,
yeah.
So the way that comics ride the laugh,
yeah.
And you know exactly when to, if there's a break before the punchline, play the punchline, and then ride the laughter for the next line coming in. It's a real craft.
It is a craft.
In the same way that Tom Lehrer does it. Yeah, it is. And Tom Lehrer does it in Poisoning Pigeons in the Park.
Yeah.
There's what's the first gag? I think actually it's the first mention of poisoning pigeons in the park. All the world seems in tune after spring afternoon when we're poisoning pigeons in the park. And he just sits there for an extra bar every sun, just because there's a ripple of laughter. That first realization about what he's built up with a beautiful verse and the payoff of that first gag. It's about giving the audience time, which is tricky when you're doing a musical comedy act or a musical a funny song, because normally the songs would just kind of chug on but those well-crafted ones, as we found and we've talked about there, give that space for the audience to laugh. Otherwise, because also if you plow on, in the same way if a comic was plowing on through gags and not giving the audience time to laugh, A, it puts the audience on a back foot, and B, they feel shortchanged
because
they haven't had that chance to laugh.
It disrupts the rhythm, doesn't it? There's a sort of rhythm of giving people space to laugh and allowing that to subside and then picking it up again.
Well, it was interesting to see that, of course, back in the rehearsal room for Three Men and a Boat. There's so many little moments and actually so much of the kind of physical comedy, I suppose, as well. Those little moments about where you created those moments where it gives the audience the opportunity to laugh. It's not kind of telegraphing a laugh, but it gives the audience chance to laugh and a time to do it. Because otherwise, as an audience, you feel kind of shortchanged. Yeah.
And sometimes the more space you allow the audience, the funnier it gets.
Absolutely. The classic thing about leaving the gag, that extra little moment, leaving that awkward kind of pregnant pause on stage just for that extra beat that actually sometimes can give you two laughs out of that moment. It's amazing. And again, from a craft point of view, that feeling that you can't, as much as you can create that or try and create that in a rehearsal room, actually it's only when you speak those words on stage in front of an audience does it actually come alive. And also that then you can, depending on the audience, I suppose, you mold that and you change that. I mean, I remember in my days as a musical director, so after university, I ended up as a keyboard player and a musical director on theatre shows, which was great fun, touring the UK. I played every number one touring venue. Some of them a couple of times, and I played some of the B and C and D and Z venues as well. I played some absolute dives in my time. But in doing that, in playing a show, the same show, for example, I mean, I did Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat as my kind of first job. And I did that for a year. And as musical director, 6 months of that. Wow. So it was 12 shows a week in a week in every venue. But even within that, there were moments in the show where, for example, at the end of Close Every Door to Me, a beautiful soaring song. And you as a musical director, it's your choice about when you bring the downbeat in for the next song.
Okay, yeah.
Depending on the reaction from the audience, you can give that little extra moment before the next chord comes in while Joseph's in the prison cell. And you can really, through that, you can mould and manipulate the audience.
There's a real emotion, isn't there, in that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And also the way that singers do it too, I suppose, if a moment really is flying or singing in a particular performance, having that little extra moment on that high note or having that slightly longer... I always love those moments. Les Mis is a perfect example, with kind of outros. Once someone stopped singing, that moment before the audience applaud, so sometimes the note might carry on and continue right to the end, and the orchestra and the vocal come off exactly together, and that's a powerful thing. But also, if the vocal stops and the orchestra keep playing, because the orchestra keep playing, you haven't given the audience permission to clap yet. So you can, there's a certain amount of kind of playing with that. And I don't use the word milking. It's not about milking it, but it's about being creative in that moment and playing the show for almost as if it's for the first time also, and afresh for that audience. Yeah. That it's not like, yes, when you're working on a major musical, yes, it is like working in a box factory, that you're creating the same box every show. Must be the same for productions that you've worked on, if you do for, especially for Edinburgh, I suppose, where, it's the same show day in, day out for a month and a bit. But it's within that, it's finding those moments within the structure of a show, within the structure of a musical, where you can have that ability to play with the ebb and flow and create something that feels fresh and new rather than a kind of hackneyed old Wednesday matinee when everyone's just lost the will to live.
I can only imagine that working on a big musical is much more military in terms of what you have to deliver.
I think military is a good term for it, actually. Because there's a hierarchy, and equally, as we were talking earlier on about preserving the text or preserving the composer or the lyricist's intentions. In the same way, especially on touring productions, which I worked on, which were 9 times out of 10 revivals of already existing productions. Yeah. So the Joseph tour had already been running for years. And when I did the Sound of Music tour, that was the production that came out of the Palladium. So it had already been created. That version had already been created by Jeremy Sams, for example, for the Palladium. And so that was the way that it was done on tour. All of the kind of backstory for all the characters, all of the research and all the kind of emotional kind of backstory that the characters would discuss in rehearsals and things is all and movements and blocking and the reasons why someone's coming from a certain side of the stage was all down to in that original rehearsal room with Jeremy Sams creating that production. Whereas then when you're on tour, it's up to you to recreate that. And so there is a certain kind of as I said, the kind of box factory feel, yeah. or as you're saying, the military thing where there's a hierarchy. It's like, as an assistant MD, for example, if I was conducting the show, I couldn't change anything. I had to do it the way that the musical director would do it.
Yeah.
In the same way that the musical director was reproducing the way that the musical supervisor had intended it to be played, or the tempo, or the cutoffs and the way it was shaped.
Yeah.
So yeah, unfortunately, on those kind of bigger shows, it is there. It's hard to find those little moments that you can kind of play with it, which is why I do enjoy creating projects and material on a much smaller scale,
yeah.
and having that ability to be in the rehearsal room and work on things and create things. It's a great fun to do.
Well, I suppose that's why the piano entertainer you mentioned earlier has such an enormous kind of power, really, because it's not just it's not a stand-up comedian. It's with all that kind of emotional those emotional levers as well, literally at their fingers.
It's great fun, especially when I'm playing in a pub gig, or an old people's kind of single, or kind of a residential care home, or a community group. It's about it, I kind of liken it a bit to being like a maybe not a stand-up, because I'm not kind of funny in it, but I have to read the room.
Yeah.
And I could just go in and sing my standard set list of songs, but that does no service to the people that are coming. Then if it's an older crowd, I'll focus on songs that they'll perhaps remember more, or tell stories or reminisce about the performers of those, yeah. songs that they might remember from the 40s and the 50s or the 60s even. But yeah, the ability as a performer, as any performer, I suppose, to be able to take an audience on a journey, I always find that as an exciting and quite daunting thing to have, because it's up to me to craft an evening to hopefully provide some enjoyment, yeah. hopefully to provide some education, hopefully to provide some nostalgic memories, I always love, and actually it's one thing I've kind of become a bit more confident with over the last, well, since starting the kind of thing about 6 years ago, in that I could go and play whatever the room's like, whoever they're there, I can play a set list of songs that will tap into them.
Yeah.
And actually quite a lot of that is while I'm playing something, I'm like a swan, that thing looking graceful on the top, but all the cogs are going on in my brain. As soon as I start, I mean, even if I'm playing in a pub gig in London, I'll start perhaps with my usual kind of, maybe it's because I'm a Londoner and Daisy and I'm forever blowing bubbles. But while I'm playing that, I am scanning the room.
Right.
I'm seeing who's singing along. I'm seeing what kind of groups are going on, whether it's parties, whether it's birthdays, whether it's a family group, whether it's different ages, different nationalities, of course. If I'm playing in London, often I get people coming from all over the, yeah. world, who've seen my stuff on YouTube or through other collaborations I've done on YouTube. So they come and, we wanted to hunt you down and see you because we were coming over and we saw you on Jules Guides, a friend of mine who has a YouTube channel with things to do in London, a few things that I've done with him. And so they come from all over the world. So equally, they might not know the stuff that we consider as kind of sing-along classics.
Yeah.
So it's also about tagging into that. So I might sing a song that's appropriate to where they come from or that they might know. I mean, the surefire hit that everybody knows, irrespective of where they come from in the world, not only is Bohemian Rhapsody, is also You Are My Sunshine. You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy when skies are grey. A 1940s cowboy song from the States.
Yes.
But everybody knows it. It's one of those ones that's just kind of gone into common parlance. So I suppose it helps that the tune for the verse and the chorus are identical.
Yeah.
So there's only one thing to learn. And so if you've got the lyrics for the chorus or the verse, you can sing them along and you know it. But yeah, it's funny that everybody seems to know that.
Yeah.
But playing to a room like that and being able to take requests or to sing something that I think is going to capture. I mean, the toughest crowds, of post-work drinkers. It doesn't matter what they're like. If I sing Mary Poppins, everybody sings.
Really?
Yeah, there's some, even the kind of staunch kind of suited and booted kind of city types who might be out for a work's do. They all know, let's go fly a kite, believe me.
Wow, that's great.
It's funny. But I suppose that taps into a kind of a childhood nostalgia for people of a certain age, or equally it's a nostalgia of watching that film with children or grandchildren as well. So, I mean, it makes me wonder in 100 years' time, what are the songs we're going to be singing?
Well,
will we be singing the Spice Girls?
Tell me what you really want.
I don't know.
I've certainly noticed that Beatles songs are in that position now. You know.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know what the sort of next turn will be. Yeah, maybe.
I think there's I don't know. In my kind of research and in just gigging in trying to encourage people to sing along, there is a kind of cutoff. For kind of well-known songs that everybody seems to know in the kind of late 70s, early 80s. So you get things, I think Queen is probably the last kind of bastions of sing-along classics.
Yeah.
So Queen, the Beatles, of course, ABBA, everybody knows,
of course, yeah.
Dancing Queen or Mamma Mia. And again, I suppose also for the fact that even a younger generation knows that through Mamma Mia, the musical and the film. Mm. So those songs, and again, it's those kind of songs, Queen too, that I remember. Actually, I remember both ABBA and Queen being introduced to from my parents. It wasn't a musical, particularly musical kind of singing household, but we'd often have musical in the car. So be that the Bee Gees or Queen's Greatest Hits or ABBA or my mum was a big Cliff Richard fan. So all the kind of Cliff Richard stuff as well. Yeah. But it's funny that those songs are the ones. Yeah, the Beatles and Queen and ABBA are, I suppose, I don't want to say the last sing-along hits, because I'm sure there's stuff more modern that, I mean, Baby Shark, does that count as something more modern that everybody knows?
Yeah. I think people sing along to Wonderwall, don't they?
And actually, again, people of a certain generation remembering songs from their kind of teenage years. Yeah. So kind of Blur, Oasis, all that kind of stuff that I was never a great fan, but I do remember. Yes, despite me sounding like I'm 80. yes, I'm 38. I missed that kind of poppy generation thing. It was never really my bag. I was in a music room at school playing show tunes, I'm afraid.
I suppose the logical question is where are the sort of the clever lyricists now? You know, and the only one I can think of at the moment is Tim Minchin.
Indeed, absolutely. Again, a great exponent of comedy at the keyboard.
Yeah.
I mean, some of his stuff isn't a gift, and obviously his musicals too. I am yet to see Boy in the Dress. That's his, isn't it?
Yes, believe it is. Yes.
But I've seen Matilda and I know the score for Matilda well, and it's glorious. It's again just to see him live with or on TV with just the piano and himself. I mean, again, a real kind of, there's that real legacy of comedy at keyboard. Yeah. So going back, I mean, even before Flanders and Swan, I mean, I love in the 1920s and 30s there was a comedy duo called the Two Leslies. Yes. Leslie Holmes and Leslie Cerrone. And actually they gave us all those kind of songs that things like Susanna's The Old Sow. There was an old farmer, had no sow, idly down. Susanna's a wonderful man, and idly down. Or I lift up my finger and I say, tweet, tweet, shush, shush, now, come, come. I mean, they don't write them like that anymore. But yeah, they kind of popularized those. And then I suppose Flanders and Swan, and also a duo called Flotsam and Jetsam, kind of similar time to Flanders and Swan. But then, of course, I mean, actually, nowadays in comedy writing as well, Fascinating Aida.
Of course.
Yeah. For a kind of female take on it.
Yeah.
Big fan of Fascinating Aida. And they've got some, they've been doing some great stuff recently, actually. And actually, a good friend of mine, Michael Ralston, is their regular pianist now, musical director. So although Dilly Keane plays a number of the songs herself, Michael also plays with them.
Right.
And he's fantastic. Actually, he's a great comedy song composer and lyricist. He and his writing partner, Sarah Louise Young, as well. They write great modern kind of cabaret comedy songs as well. So if anyone's interested in kind of modern cabaret comedy, then yes, Michael Ralston and Sarah Louise Young, definitely worth a look. Because again, writing about things that we all deal with. There's a great song on their latest album about like a National Trust gift shop. let's all go into the gift shop to find something of delight. As beautiful lyric set to a kind of like marchy tune. Cool. It's wonderful. Yeah. And also the disappointing sandwich about when you go to a petrol station and all you can find to buy is the disappointing sandwich. It's a kind of an analogy for life, I suppose. But yeah, so comedy at the keyboard is continuing. Yeah. Yeah. And it follows on in that kind of grand tradition, yeah. I suppose.
Well, I'm guessing from everything we talked about that you're desperate to get back to live performing.
Oh, I can't tell you how much I am. I mean, if the virus would just disappear overnight, I would be straight back to pushing that piano out. As much as I hate pushing the piano out the van and getting it back in and pushing, I dread to think how heavy it is as well. I'm going to get a hernia one of these days. But no, I would love to. Because, of course, what I do is relies on audience interaction. Yeah. Though having said that, I've been really kind of blown away with the reaction that the online sing-along has had.
Yes, thousands. I mean, thousands and thousands.
Who would have ever thought that a sing-along sung alone would work?
Great.
But I think that's the thing. But people are singing along and joining in at home. Yeah. I'll produce song books that people can download each week, and there'll be songs in there that they'll know, and there might be some songs that I'll do that people might not know, but just kind of silly little songs like the Leslie Cerrone songs or what was it, Leslie Cerrone song I did the other week, 47 ginger-headed sailors. 47 ginger-headed sailors coming home across the briny sea. Which I first heard back in the late 90s. It made an appearance in Jeeves and Wooster, the TV program with Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie. Because there's some lovely moments in that where Hugh Laurie sits at the piano and plonks away, and Jeeves looks disapprovingly and comments on the songs of the day. 47 Ginger-Headed Sailors. I mean, someone requested it a few weeks ago and I did it.
Yeah.
And then someone dropped me a line saying, "Oh my god, I didn't realise that was a real song. I thought my nan made it up."
Oh yes, yeah.
So it's fascinating how, well, the same with things like "My Baby Has Gone Down the Plug Hole." Do you know that?
Yes, yeah.
And my baby has gone down the plug. Oh, so your baby has gone down the plug. The poor little thing was so skinny and thin. It should have been bathed in a jug. In a jug. Your baby is ever so happy. He won't need a bath anymore. Your baby has gone down the plug hole. Not lost, but gone before. That was written. It's a traditional song. It's a music hall song from the mid 1800s. Though the origins of it are unknown, and there's no lyricist attributed to it. It was released in the 1960s by a band called Cream, I think.
Really?
And became a hit then. And so again, many people know that song from the 1960s. Yeah. But equally, an older generation would remember it from, it's the kind of pub sing-along songs that have been passed on and that would have been, again, not written down, but you'd go, hear something in the pub one Friday night, someone would be playing something on the piano, you might get the sheet music, or equally, you would hear it in the pub every week, so you'd gradually learn the words and pass it on.
There's a real kind of, I don't know, unknown or undiscovered kind of tradition of this that you seem to be preserving, at least with, you know, as I say, tens of thousands of people watching it on Facebook. I'm sure that there are lots of younger people as well listening to it as well.
Yeah, it's amazing. When I play at Wilton's Music Hall, which is the oldest grand surviving music hall in the world, in East London, in Limehouse, just off Cable Street, a beautiful, beautiful venue. And when I play there, I could be playing to youngest, I mean, like teenagers or even younger. We've had kind of school kids in, through to people in their 80s and 90s. And it's funny that so many of these songs we all have a collective frame of reference for. So things like, again, "I'm Henry the Eighth, I Am," originally written in 1911, Harry Champion. It's a great song. But so a lot of people would know that, especially kind of Cockney families or London families because it's just a kind of sing-along song. But of course, it appears in, is it Ghost, the film?
Oh, does it?
Yeah, I think Patrick Swayze sings it at some point. So it's one of those songs that's kind of in common parlance, in kind of common knowledge. And of course, it was released by Herman's Hermits in the 1960s. And of course, they only recorded the the chorus. I'm Henry the Eighth, I am Henry the Eighth, I am. And they released it, and it went to the top of the Billboard charts in the States. So again, like people in America know I'm Henry the Eighth, I am from the chorus, but they've never heard the verse before. So it's funny just how these songs kind of get rediscovered over time. Things like Daisy Daisy as well, being it's 2001, The Space Odyssey, isn't it? Where Hal the computer, as it's breaking down at the end, that's what it sings. I mean, actually, it was inspired by the fact that Daisy Bell was the first, let me get this right, was the first song to be sung by a synthesized computer voice back in the, would it be in the 80s, I think? It was the first song to use a kind of vocal processor that created the kind of Daisy, Daisy, give me a round to you, which inspired Stanley Kubrick to put it in the film. But the fact that these songs still live on, and as we said earlier on, who knows, in 100 years, will these still be the songs we're singing? I think the answer is probably
I think some of them certainly.
Maybe not the un-PC ones.
No, but it's quite fun to discover those again, isn't it?
Oh, my word. There are plenty of them, and plenty of them that should most definitely stay on a shelf or in the archives and never be. I mean, we're in a different world now. And even something like, I sang last night and didn't think about it at all. It's a World War One song, Katie.
Yes.
But it's written about a speech impediment. It's written about someone stammering. I thought originally it was just someone being nervous because of Katie, beautiful Katie, you're the only girl that I adore. He's nervous. But no, if you look at the original sheet music, it's the stammering sensation.
Yes.
And I was like, it's, And actually, if you listen to the original record, one of the original recordings of it as well, I can't remember who did it, but he was kind of famed for his kind of stammering imitation. And I have to say that recording's pretty offensive if you listen to it.
Yeah.
So I don't know, maybe some of these songs, need to just kind of quietly fizzle into, or as I said, again, I suppose it's a bit like, the whole kind of thing about erasing history, I suppose, and a conversation that's going on at the moment, that actually I'm a firm believer that we shouldn't erase stuff, that we should, that things should be. And I mean, the same goes for all the kind of minstrel songs. And there was a real kind of popular tradition at the turn of the century, or the late 1800s and early 1900s, for kind of minstrel, British kind of musical performers playing blackface, basically, and that kind of and emulating those African minstrel acts that toured over into the UK in the 1800s, in the 1850s and 60s. So they were just kind of echoing that and shadowing that. But there's so much of that material and stuff that is in common knowledge. Things like She's My Lady Love, Lily of Laguna. She's my lady love. She is my dove, my baby love, sung by Eugene Stratton, who was a blackface minstrel.
Really?
We must be aware that that went on and how that it came out of that time. But I certainly think, that we shouldn't be glorifying any of that or we can't erase it. But equally, I think there's stuff that should kind of quietly just sit at the back and be there for history. I don't think
anyone wants to kind of delete them, but you have to you have to use them or refer to them sensitively, don't you? Because
I mean even
going back to Flanders and Swan, even that Have Some Madeira, I thought it's slightly dodgy.
Getting a young girl drunk and having your wicked way, I suppose. Indeed. I mean, so many of these songs were quite near the knuckle. I mean, again, talking about songs about the whole innuendo thing, And especially in the music hall songs, and especially at the end of the 1800s, the real kind of the Mari Lloyd stuff that we remember, things like, I mean, there's the apocryphal story, which I'm afraid is not true, that there is a song that she sang called "She Sits Amongst the Cabbages and Peas." And that the Lord Chamberlain said, basically banned it because it was too offensive. And so she changed the lyrics to "She sits amongst the cauliflowers and leeks." But unfortunately, as much as I've heard that story being recounted many, many, many times, as far as I'm aware, and as far as my friends at the British Music Hall Society are aware, it never existed. It's just a story. but things like "A Little of What You Fancy Does You Good."
Yes. Yeah.
Or... "She'd Never Had a Ticket Punched Before." All those kind of, "With Me Little Wigger Wagger in My Hand." A kind of dandy song, yeah. from the turn of the century, "With a Little Wigger Wagger in My Hand." I mean, again, they don't write them like they used to. And they're certainly, or even in the 1950s, "Oh, What a Beauty," the Marrow song. "I've never seen one as big as that before." Yeah. I mean, yeah, some of them are innuendo and some of them are most definitely outuendo.
Yes.
It's like there's no, yeah, there's definitely, I suppose then again, you get things like George Formby with "A Little Stick of Blackpool Rock,"
yeah.
Understandably banned by the BBC.
Along
also with, I won't mention the name of the song, but one that I performed last night, a Harry Roy song.
Yes.
About a cat.
Yes,
which was. If people want to have a look for Harry Roy, "My Girls," it's there. You can find it. It was a legitimate song from the 1920s.
Favorite of Champagne Charlie and the Bubbly Boys, indeed,
my good friend Champagne Charlie. Yes, a great chum, and one of our favorites to play together. It's great kind of tongue in cheek innuendo, but I would hazard a guess to say that even back then it was. The innuendo was well known enough to obviously it was banned by the BBC. It was blatant enough to raise their eyebrows.
I think there's a whole other show in those kind of songs, isn't there? I mean, I know we talked about the possibility of an Edinburgh show with some of those kind of songs, and some of the songs that were, I suppose they'd now be LGBT.
Indeed, yeah. Especially those the kind of songs that Champagne Charlie, for example, specializes in. He has a great love of, all those kind of rebellion songs from the Weimar Republic from the 1930s. So kind of in the run up to the Second World War, the kind of the underground cabaret scene, I suppose, in Germany.
Yeah.
And which I suppose is kind of iconic. I suppose that we recognise the images from something like Cabaret, the movie with Joel Grey and Liza Minnelli. But yeah, the very much that kind of Weimar and the real kind of resistance in song. Charlie does a great version of the Lavender Song, which I urge anyone who's interested in that kind of music to have a look at. A great kind of a great kind of stirring anthem for LGBT rights and being accepted in as who you are, be that whoever and however you are. It's a great song, the Lavender Song, highly recommended.
So it just reminded me of Mad About the Boy as well, going back to Noel Coward, of course.
Which I think the greatest version of that I've ever heard are male versions. Actually Dusty Limits, a good friend of mine, Dusty Limits, another cabaret performer, does it.
Really?
And it's beautiful. And what's again, even the kind of underlying homosexual kind of subtones, especially in things like Cole Porter's work. Cole Porter, who was of course back in the day, his sexuality was hidden. He was married to Linda Lee Porter. It was all kind of glossed over, as it were. But things like, what was it, Love for Sale.
Yes.
A beautiful song, and I think the story goes that he wrote it about a male prostitute, not a female prostitute. But then again, it's been covered many times over the years. And other things, I love the version of Bewitched, Bothered and Bewildered that they do in The History Boys.
Oh, yes.
When is it Posner sings it? He's a Fool and Don't I Know It. I'll sing to him each spring to him and long for the trousers that cling to him. I'm not sure whether those are an original version, but it's beautiful. It is, and yeah. And a great version of that. Again, highlighting the fact that these songs that we, I suppose I make a living from singing the choruses because that's what people know. Mm. And I introduce where I can the lyrics and the verses for these songs because they've got stories to tell alongside things like My Old Man Said Follow the Van, which sounds like a jolly chorus, but it's about a midnight flit in the middle of the night to pack up all your belongings on the cart because you can't afford to pay the rent. The family put everything on the cart, drive it away. She's had too many to drink. She can't find a way to a new address. So we all know the chorus, but we don't necessarily know the story behind the verse. No. Same with all those beautiful Tin Pan Alley songs from the 20s and 30s. Those songs like Bewitched, Bothered and Bewildered. She's a fool and don't I know it, but a fool can have her charms. I'm in love and don't I know it, like a babe in arms. Beautiful, beautiful verses that when those songs were covered in the 40s and 50s by the kind of Rat Pack singers and even kind of Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald and things, often those verses aren't done. It's just all about the chorus. And it's a real shame because there are beautiful verses. And again, talking about the craft of creating a song and a lyric that pays off. There are so many of those lyrics that have a great payoff in the chorus. Even things like, I was singing only the other week, Bluebirds Over the White Cliffs of Dover and We'll Meet Again, two great Vera Lynn classics. Mm. In tribute to Vera Lynn, who we lost last week, 103, what a great innings and what a great legacy of the songs that she left. Yeah. But those have got great verses that nobody ever sings. Let's smile, dear, for a while, dear, we must part. Don't let the parting upset you. I'll not forget you, sweetheart. We'll meet again, Donna. Like 8 bars. Mm. But it's a beautiful, beautiful little, and it adds so much extra colour to the song, which often can be lost if those verses aren't sung. Yeah. So, no, I'm a firm believer. If you can share the verse as well, it just adds to the, again, more than the sum of the parts. Yeah. It's a real bonus to a song.
Yeah, yeah. Well, listen, I was just going to come back to the quadlibet or quodlibet.
Indeed.
Because there was one that was in my mind as you were saying that, and it's the trying to think who wrote it. You're Just in Love, you know, the one.
Yes,
I hear singing and there's no one there.
Okay.
Irving Berlin, isn't it? Yeah. It's Irving Berlin. What's it from? I can't remember now.
I have to Google it.
But anyway, it's famously sung by Ethel Merman and someone, and that was just counter melodies.
A counter melody, absolutely. Yeah. So yeah, unlike two songs which fit together, it's that the same way. There's a great one in the musical version of Thoroughly Modern Millie, the two leading ladies sing a beautiful duet, and they actually Irving Berlin also did. Annie, Get Your Gun.
Oh, yeah, maybe it's
and I want an old-fashioned wedding made in a good old-fashioned way. And then Annie sings, I want a big church with those maids and carousel. So, again, a simultaneous quodlibet, those two melodies that work independently as separate entities, I suppose, but put them together, and I mean, I suppose the kids nowadays would call it a mashup.
Yes,
is that what? Yes, is, I suppose it would. Or am I a few years out of date?
No, I think that's right.
You call it a mashup. Yeah. It's amazing. But there are so many.
I've just looked.
It's
from Call Me Madam.
Oh, go on. There we go. Yeah. Of course.
Anyway, yes.
Yeah, Ethel Merman. What a voice. Yeah. But yeah, those kind of mashups. And actually, it's a common thing to be used in, I'm not down with the kids, as it were, but in kind of modern music and modern kind of DJing and editing stuff together as well. That finding those moments, those musical moments that fit together. I mean, certainly a few years ago, Glee were doing it. The TV program Glee were all over it. And that kind of legacy of and actually a lot of kind of choirs and choral societies, especially in the American thing, the kind of a cappella groups as well do it a lot, where they where you find similarities between songs and mash them all together. Yeah. It's a clever little device. And probably comes up more often than people would assume. Yeah.
But it's a fun one, and thank you for introducing me to it.
Pleasure. You can have that one for free.
The other meaning of it is a topic for or exercise in philosophical discussion.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, thank you for that, Phil.
So it's the perfect word for what we've been doing. I think we've got to do it again. Because there's so much to talk about, and
we could talk for hours. Yeah. I'm sorry.
No, it's great. No, I've hardly had to do anything, but it's fascinating, and I really do want us to get back to live performance very, very, very quickly.
Oh, I can't wait! Yeah. I can't wait. I'm having seen the roadmap put out by the
Devon. Stunning.
stunningly grey. Yeah, really. Yeah. No idea of timescales. I mean, I suppose my problem with gigging for me is the fact that I will be in that lot. Well, I will probably be in, I think it was like stage five. I will be in stage six because stage five is audiences coming together to watch a show without social distancing. Whereas for me, it will be people in an audience singing into each other's faces, which I think at the moment, or certainly while the virus is around, is kind of highly dangerous.
Yeah, it's really tough, isn't
so,
it?
So, who knows? I don't know how I'm going to kind of pivot over this time. It was interesting to hear Ian on the last podcast and you were talking about the kind of creativity in the lockdown. I found it really hard to find the motivation and find the time.
I agree.
With kind of family things. I've got an 8-year-old son who I've been helping through his home learning. So that's kind of eaten up a lot of time. And then equally, I suppose just in not being my usual busy kind of gigging self, I'm just struggling to find that motivation to be creative. Yeah. So I'm looking forward to hopefully finding some more time going forward because, if I'm not out gigging, I've got to be doing something.
Well, we're going to have to write that show I was telling you about. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes. Well, when we can get back to a pub or maybe outdoor pint, a socially distanced pint outdoors and have a chat.
Yeah.
Because as long as you don't mind songs sounding like something else.
No, that's perfect. I think we've established that's perfectly acceptable.
There we go. As long as it sounds it doesn't sound too much like Victoria Wood or Tom Lear, we'll be okay.
Could do a lot worse.
Absolutely.
Brilliant, Tom. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Great to chat.
Thank you for that. Thank you so much. So, that was Tom Carradine. And what a pleasure to speak to him. What a talented chap. And as you could tell from that hour and a bit that we spent together, I didn't really get a word in edgeways. But I love talking to Tom because he knows so much about music and he has such a love of the performance and the entertainment value of music and songs. So if you would like to hear more from Tom, you can join him for his sing-along on Facebook. Just search for Carradine's Cockney Sing-Along, or you can look for Tom Carradine Pianist on Facebook, or you can go and look at his website, Carradine's Cockney Sing-Along, all one word, .co.uk. You can follow him on Twitter, at Tom Carradine, everything leads back to his regular Thursday evening, which has become a bit of a cult following during the lockdown period into week 15 or something. But every week is a great chance to just have a sing-along and have a shout-out to your friends and family while you sing some of these great songs that Tom knows like the back of his hand. So thanks for listening. Don't forget to look out for new episodes of Ideas in Writing, produced with Mr. Books Bookshop in Tunbridge. And I think it's entirely appropriate to play out with our real theme tune this week. So thanks again for listening. I'm Phil Holden, and see you next time. Hello, if you enjoyed this podcast, you can support us. Just need to click on the link and become an Acast supporter. It's a one-off donation. You can give as much or as little as you like, and there's no commitment, but it certainly helps us to keep producing these podcasts. So thank you very much.